the floor to the distinguished foreign minister of Israel.
Je donne la parole à Monsieur le ministre des Affaires étrangères d'Israël.
I thank you, Mr. President, for giving me this opportunity to address the Council. I've just come from Jerusalem to tell the Security Council that Israel, by her independent effort and sacrifice, has passed from serious danger to successful resistance. 2 days ago, her condition caused much concern across the humane and friendly world. Israel had reached a somber hour. Let me try to evoke the point at which our fortunes stood. An army greater than any force ever assembled in history in Sinai had massed against Israel's southern frontier. Egypt had dismissed the United Nations forces, which symbolized the international interest in the maintenance of peace in our region. Nasser had provocatively brought 5 infantry divisions and 2 armored divisions up to our very gates. 80,000 men and 900 tanks were poised to move. A special striking force comprising an armored division with at least 200 tanks was concentrated against Eilat at the Negev's southern tip. Here was a clear design to cut the southern Negev off from the main body of our state. For Egypt had openly proclaimed that Eilat did not form part of Israel and had predicted that Israel itself would soon expire. The proclamation was empty. The prediction now lies in ruin. While the main brunt of hostile threat was focused on the southern front, an alarming plan of encirclement was underway. With Egypt's initiative and guidance, Israel was already being strangled in her maritime approaches to the whole eastern half of the world. For 16 years, she had been illicitly denied passage in the Suez Canal, despite this Security Council's decision of the 1st of September, 1951. And now the creative enterprise of 10 patient years, which had opened an international route across the Tehran Straits and the Gulf of Aqaba, had been suddenly and arbitrarily choked. Israel was and is breathing with only a single lung. Jordan had been intimidated against her better interest into joining a defense pact. It is not a defense pact at all. It is an aggressive pact, of which I saw the consequences with my own eyes yesterday in the shells falling upon institutions of health and culture in the city of Jerusalem. Every house and street in Jerusalem now came into the range of fire. As a result of Jordan's adherence to this pact, so also was the crowded and pathetically narrow coastal strip in which so much of Israel's life and population are concentrated. Iraqi troops reinforced Jordanian units in areas immediately facing vital and vulnerable Israeli communication centers. Expeditionary forces from Algeria and Kuwait had reached Egyptian territory. Nearly all the Egyptian forces which had been attempting the conquest of the Yemen had been transferred to the coming assault upon Israel. The Syrian units, including artillery, overlooked the Israeli villages in the Jordan Valley. Terrorist groups came regularly into our territory to kill, plunder, and explode, the most recent of them 5 days ago. In short, there was peril for Israel wherever she looked. Her manpower had been hastily mobilized. Her economy and commerce were beating with feeble pulse. Her streets were dark and empty. There was an apocalyptic air of approaching peril. And Israel faced this danger alone. We were buoyed up by an unforgettable surge of public sympathy across the world. The friendly governments expressed the rather ominous hope that Israel would manage to live. But the dominant theme of our condition was danger and solitude. Now, there could be no doubt about what was intended for us. With my very ears, I heard President Nasser's speech on May the 26th. He said, "We intend to open a general assault against Israel. This will be total war. Our basic aim is the destruction of Israel." On June the 2nd, the Egyptian commander in Sinai, General Murtagi, published his order of the day, calling on his troops to wage a war of destruction against Israel. Here, then, was a systematic, overt, proclaimed design at politicide, the murder of a state. The policy, the arms, the men had all been brought together. And the state thus threatened with collective assault was itself the last sanctuary of a people which had seen 6 million of its sons exterminated by a more powerful dictator 2 decades before. Now, the question then widely asked in Israel and across the world was whether we had not already gone beyond the utmost point of danger. Was there any precedent in world history, for example, for a nation passively to suffer the blockade of its only southern port, involving nearly all its vital fuel, when such acts of war, legally and internationally, have always invited resistance? This was a most unusual patience. It existed because we had acceded to the suggestion of some of the maritime states that we give them scope to concert their efforts in order to find an international solution which would ensure the maintenance of free passage in the Gulf of Aqaba for ships of all nations and of all flags. As we pursued this avenue of international solution, we wished the world to have no doubt of our readiness to exhaust every prospect, however fragile, of a diplomatic solution. And some of the prospects that were suggested were very fragile indeed. But as time went on, there was no doubt that our margin of general security was becoming smaller and smaller. And thus, on the morning of June the 5th, when Egyptian forces engaged us by air and land, bombarding the villages of Kisufim, Nahal Oz, and Tsur Maon, we knew that our limit of safety had been reached and perhaps passed, in accordance with her inherent right of self-defense, as formulated in Article 51 of the United Nations Charter. Israel responded defensively in full strength. Never in the history of nations has armed force been used in a more righteous or compelling cause. Mr. President, even when engaged with Egyptian forces, we still hoped to contain the conflict. Egypt was overtly bent on our destruction. We still hoped that others would not join the aggression. Prime Minister Eshkol, who for weeks had carried the heavy burden of calculation and decision, published and conveyed a message to other neighboring states proclaiming, "We shall not attack any country unless it opens war on us. Even now, when the mortars speak, we have not given up our quest for peace. We strive to repel all menace of terrorism and any danger of aggression to ensure our security and our legitimate rights." In accordance with this same policy of attempting to contain the conflict, I yesterday invited General Bull, the chairman of the Truce Supervision Organization, to inform the heads of the Jordanian state that Israel had no desire to expand the conflict beyond the unfortunate dimensions that it had already assumed, and that if Israel were not attacked on the Jordan side, we would not attack and would act only in self-defense. It reached my ears that this message had been duly and faithfully conveyed and received. Nevertheless, Jordan decided to join the Egyptian posture against Israel and opened artillery attacks across the whole long frontier, including Jerusalem. These attacks are still in progress. To the appeal of the Prime Minister Eshkol to avoid any further extension of the conflict, Syria answered at 12:25 yesterday morning by bombing Megiddo from the air and bombing Dejama at 12:40 with artillery fire, and kibbutz Ein HaMifratz and Kurdani with long-range guns. But Jordan embarked on a much more total assault by artillery and aircraft along the entire front, with special emphasis on Jerusalem, to whose dangerous and noble ordeal yesterday I come to bear personal witness. There has been bombing of houses. There's been a hit on the great new National Museum of Art. There has been a hit on the university, on the hospital Shaare Tzedek, the first hospital ever to have been established outside the ancient walls. Is this not an act of vandalism that deserves the condemnation of all mankind? And in the Knesset building, whose construction had been movingly celebrated by the entire democratic world 10 months ago, the Israeli cabinet and parliament met under heavy gunfire, whose echoes mingled at the end of our meeting with Hatikva, the anthem of hope. And thus, throughout the day and night of the 5th of June, Jordan, whom we had expressly invited to abstain from needless slaughter, became, to our surprise, and still remains, the most intense of all the belligerents, and death and injury, as so often in history, stalk Jerusalem's streets. Mr. Chairman, when the approaching Egyptian aircraft appeared on our radar screens, soon to be followed by artillery attacks on our villages near the Gaza Strip, I instructed Ambassador Rafael to inform the Security Council, in accordance with the provisions of Article 51 of the Charter. I know that this involved arousing you, Mr. Chairman, at a most uncongenial hour of the night, but we felt that the Security Council should be most urgently seized. I should, however, be less than frank if I were to conceal the fact that the government and people of Israel have been disconcerted by some aspects of the United Nations' role in this conflict. The sudden withdrawal of the United Nations Emergency Force was not accompanied, as it should have been, by due international consultation on the consequences of that withdrawal. Moreover, Israeli interests were affected. They were not adequately explored. No attempt was made, little time given, to help Israel surmount grave prejudice to her vital interests consequent on that withdrawal. After all, a new confrontation of forces suddenly arose. It suddenly had to be met. And at Sharm el-Sheikh, at the entrance to the Gulf of Aqaba, the Straits of Tiran, legality walked out, blockade walked in. The peace of the world trembled. And thus the United Nations had somehow been put into a position of leaving Sinai safe for belligerency. It is not, I think, a question of sovereignty that is here involved. The United Nations has a right to ask that when it assumes a function, that the termination of that function shall not take place in conditions that would lead to anti-charter situations. I do not raise this point in order to linger upon that which is past, but because of Israel's general attitude to the peacekeeping functions of this organization. And I confess, Mr. President, that my own attitude and those of my colleagues and of my fellow citizens to the peacekeeping functions of the United Nations have been traumatically affected by this experience. The United Nations Emergency Force rendered distinguished service. Nothing became it less than the manner of its departure. Every gratitude and appreciation is owed to the individuals who sustained its action. And if in the course of the recent combats, United Nations personnel have fallen, dead or wounded as they have, then I join my voice to an expression of the most sincere regret. The problem of the future role of United Nations presence in conflicts such as these is being much debated. But we must ask ourselves the question that has arisen as a result of this experience. People in our country and in many countries ask, what is the use of a United Nations presence if it is in effect an umbrella which is taken away as soon as it begins to rain? Surely then future arrangements for peacekeeping must depend more on the agreement and the implementation of the parties themselves than on machinery which is totally at the mercy of the host country, so totally at its mercy as to be the instrument of its policies, whatever those policies may be. Mr. President, we have lived through three dramatic weeks. Those weeks, I think, have brought into clear view the main elements of tension and also the chief promise of relaxed tension in the future. The first link in the chain was the series of sabotage acts emanating from Syria. In October last year, the Security Council was already seized of this problem, and a majority of its member states found it possible and necessary to draw attention to the Syrian government's responsibility for altering that situation. Scarcely a day passed without a mine, a bomb, a hand grenade, or a mortar exploding on Israel's soil, sometimes with lethal or crippling effects, always with unsettling psychological influence. In general, 14 or 15 such incidents would accumulate before a response was considered necessary. And this ceaseless accumulation of terrorist sabotage incidents in the name of what was called popular war, together with responses which in the long run sometimes became inevitable, were for a long period the main focus of tension in the Middle East. But then there came a graver source of tension in mid-May when abnormal troop concentrations were observed in the Sinai Peninsula. For the 10 years of relative stability, beginning with March 1957 and ending with May 1967, the Sinai Desert had been free of Egyptian troops. In other words, a natural geographic barrier, a largely uninhabited space, separated the main forces of the two sides. Now, it is true that in terms of sovereignty and law, any state has a right to put its armies in any part of its territory that it chooses. This, however, is not a legal question. It is a political and a security question. Experience in many parts of the world, not least in our own, demonstrates that massive armies in close proximity to each other against the background of a doctrine of belligerency and accompanying threats by one army to annihilate the other constitute an inflammatory situation. We were puzzled in Israel by the relative lack of preoccupation by friendly governments and by international agencies with this intense concentration, which found its reflection in precautionary concentrations on our side. My government proposed, I think at least 2 weeks ago, the concept of a parallel and reciprocal reduction of forces on both sides of the frontier. We elicited no response and certainly no action. To these grave sources of tension, the sabotage and terrorist movement emanating mostly from Syria. And the heavy troop concentrations accompanied by dire apocalyptic threats in Sinai. There was added in the third week of May the most electric shock of all, namely the closure of the international waterway composed by the Straits of Tiran and the Gulf of Aqaba.